The writer and scholar Catherine Bond Stockton has been in a lesbian relationship for 31 years. Only she's not a lesbian. Her partner isn't a lesbian either. But they are queer. And it's the perfect way to illustrate the truly elaborate nature of gender and sexuality. Stockton has written a new book, which she describes as a story of gender, the when, the why, and the what. And she uses her own story to get us started. She was assigned the category female when she was born, but she always knew two things about herself.
I wanted to be a boy, and not just wanted to be a boy, I was, and nobody seemed to recognize this fact about me. I wanted the boy word because I wanted people to speak to me as if I were a boy, and I wished to kiss girls. And yet, not being able to be a boy, the kissing of girls was a problem. And honestly, I cannot have a memory of myself when those two things didn't seem to be running side by side.
So she's got all this stuff going on in her head. And you know how it is. When you're confused, you look for something or someone to help you make sense of it. And at some point in her childhood, she came across this cheesy horror TV show called Dark Shadows. It's a soap opera.
If you would,
and the character she identified with was Barnabas Collins.
Barnabas Collins.
A vampire.
Kind of a stately gentleman, as I recall. And I'm thinking, you know, he seems like a really good guy. Like in the show, he's a favored person. But he has a problem. He likes to bite women on the neck.
Vicky.
Oh, hello, Barnabas.
I was out for a walk.
And for some reason, as a kid, that spoke to me. I felt like, I am Barnabas Collins. I have this tragic story. I am always going to want to, metaphorically, bite girls on the neck.
It's got to be all right. It's got to.
Come, put your head in my shoulder and cry all you want. Nobody will hear you but me.
I want to kiss girls. And I just began to feel like I am this monster, this sort of uncontrollable thing. No matter how good by day, no matter how affirmed in other ways, there will always be this tragic thing I want to do at the core of my person. That was really the beginning of my understanding of myself as the figure of the monster, and trying to navigate this sense of what I felt was a goodness. I didn't feel like an evil person. But I knew and got clues from the culture around me that this thing I want to do is conceived of as evil. Not just something you shouldn't do or try not to do that thing, but is actually an evil thing to do. That was confusing to me as a child, but very, very formative of the way I thought. And indeed, in growing up, I could not project any future for myself because I could not see a future where I would not want to kiss girls, but I could not see that there would ever be any context that would ever be able to hold that for me since I was called a girl, though I did not feel myself to be this thing. And one way that I would explain it is I couldn't ditch the girl word and I couldn't get the boy word, so I fell in between them, impaled upon both. I think it's maybe good to be taken back to a story of what was happening for people growing up in a time when the concept or the word trans did not exist in my world. Gender is all around us. And I think many of us would also say gendering is and around our sexuality. And then as we tell our stories, let's sort of see where that takes us. So the story that I'm telling is kind of a deep-seated collapse of the notion of gay and trans in my childhood in that time. Asking these questions about ourselves, it can be an interesting game for ourselves and an interesting way to take us into the system of sex, gender, and how it has formed us all, which I think would be very good for all of us to be thinking about.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Catherine Bond Stockton says in her new book that gender becomes something you know. It becomes something because, as she explains it, you don't know your gender, of course, when you're born. It's kind of given to you based on these clues from the culture she's talking about. Stockton is a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah. She's dean of the School for Cultural and Social Transformation there. Among her books is Making Out. This new one is called Genders. And it wasn't her idea. It was a commission from the MIT Press. They published this series of books that are supposed to be concise and accessible. But when it comes to something as complicated as gender, how is that even possible?
I was not sure I could tell this story. Now, mind you, I have taught something called first women's studies, you know, and then gender studies for about 34 years at the University of Utah. I directed a thing called gender studies for about 11 years.
Yeah, and if anyone can write about this, why couldn't you?
Yeah, you would think, okay, so how can you fear the thing you've been teaching?
Right.
But it did seem so big. It seemed so vast at this point in time that to try to tell this story in a concise way, hopefully never really essentializing what I was talking about. So it's called the Essential Knowledge Series. But of course, I'm writing the book to sort of undermine the notion of many things that we do think of as being essentialized or being natural or being fixed, you know, in some knowable way. So this is very much a book about unknowing, the process of creative, hopefully smart, playful, interesting unknowing is the project that I wanted to undertake. But I feared telling my subject concisely or in a way that would present complexity but still with pleasure to the fore and some measure of clarity that somebody leaving the book could leave with some precise notions in mind and not just feel like a jumble of ideas.
But here's something you write, and you say this right up front. You say you're not interested in a lucid, flat-footed version of gender. Mm-hmm. But lucid means clear to the understanding. So why wouldn't you want to be clear to the understanding in terms of writing about gender? Is it because we're just oversimplifying it? What do you mean by that?
Yes, and of course, oversimplification has gotten us to where we are. Yeah. So the very notion of sexing a child at birth, right? Only one of two words fixed to the body. Now, obviously, you can't fix the word to the body unless you're literally going to tattoo a child. Actually, the interesting thing is the word is not attached to the body. But it does feel, I think, to many of us like a cone was lowered at birth. That's the thing we are literally said to be on a piece of paper. This is now who I am. And I'm only one of two things. And to make it more complicated, those things have been said to be opposite sexes. So I am opposite of another thing. And it's literally, as I say later in the book, it's like we cut babies in half.
Yeah, we're going to get to opposite because it's an important idea.
Yes. So at any rate, the simplicity of creating only two things at birth, deeming them to be opposite, that's clearly a story we're telling ourselves that is far too simple for the complexity even of the thing called sex before we even get to the question of gendering.
You say gender is queer for everyone. Let's talk about that because one of the important ideas in the book is that gender is strange.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Yeah. And that's the way that I think of the word queer. So very important, and I try to get my reader comfortable with that, is that queer is not going to mean LGBTQIA+, though sometimes it does. Obviously, that's completely included in this
notion.
Not
what you mean now, right?
But not – I really want to ride that other dictionary definition, that very broad definition of strange, to say that once we do start thinking about ourselves, and that's the very first line of the book is, you know, prepare to enter a story that is yours, right? I want everybody to enter this story. Not every element will speak to you, but all of these different dynamics have been part of what has formed you. And the reason I say strange is there are so many things that are mysterious. You've already heard me refer to that, you know, in the stories that I've told. You know, whether it's Barnabas Collins and thinking I'm a vampire, that's pretty strange just because I want to kiss a girl, you know, so that's strange. But some of the most conventional notions are strange, right? And you hear me saying that, that I think it's a very strange thing to raise two human beings to imagine that they're opposite of each other, give them opposite ways to dress, opposite mindsets to pursue, opposite traits that supposedly define them, and then they're supposed to have opposite aesthetics, come together in a house, raise other little opposites, and that's what we're calling marriage as it was intended to be. I call that strange from where I sit. So some of the strangest things are the ways that we thought about the thing called heterosexuality, you know, or normal gender, all things in quotation marks here. I think there's a lot of strangeness to pursue. Mm. And I hope the book opens that up for people and makes that evident.
I want to ask one of the questions that you pose right up front in the book, and that is you write this. You write, given its intimacy to your own life, would you say you know what gender is?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think most people would answer that question right now?
Well, I've tried a little sample out
Have
there
you?
In the world. Yes, you know, even among academics, but it's been fun talking to people that I just talked to, you know, in my life, and I'll say, okay, so what do you think sex is and what do you think gender is? Mm. And if people haven't been in an academic setting, they're likely to actually reverse them from the dictionary definition, think that gender is the biological thing and sex is something else, has to do with behavior.
Yeah.
So
sex is the thing you do.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah. Of course, there's a confusion right there, right, that the word sex we use in two different ways. You know, as speakers of English, if we are speakers of English, we say, you know, biological sex, right? What is the genital reproductive configuration of this body? Mm. And then we use sex for sex acts that we do. So that word is quite confusing to many people given that sort of double valence. And I think another piece of evidence I would give is the gender reveal party. You know, these things that seemed like they, you know, came out of nowhere. And at first when I thought about them, I was just like, what are people thinking? They are not revealing a gender. How could they be revealing a gender, right? They were revealing – they think they are revealing the baby's biological sex. But in a very interesting way, which maybe we will get to, gender so much drives the notion of what we think of as sex.
Yeah.
In a very strange way, those gender reveal people may know what they're doing. They're revealing our cultural concepts that actually then are rolled right on top of our physical bodies and our genitals. Our genitals are like little magnets for mythology.
Yeah. You ask this interesting question, which again gets at something we'll keep coming back to, which is the idea of race. You say, why no cake for race?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by employing that question?
In some ways, it's really a straightforward question. Like we have these big ta-da moments, like I'm going to tell you what I am having and I slice the cake and you will see pink or blue. And then, of course, all these other permutations could be a pinata, could be many different things.
Yeah.
But we do not have a ritual that I'm aware of to reveal the baby's race. Now, as I go on to say, it's not like people don't think that. You know, somebody might see a pregnant person. Somebody, whoever they are, might think in their head, are you having a black baby or a white baby or a, you know, nobody says, are you having a middle class, you know, baby
yeah.
or a working class child? Nobody says that because that doesn't make any sense. Or, you know, are you having a gay or lesbian also, given the ways we think about, doesn't make sense. But racialization is interesting because it can show up on the birth certificate, but it is not our convention when the baby comes out of the birth canal to say what the baby is. That we think we are attaching a sex word, but I would just want to point out we don't say it's a male, it's a female. The idiom is it's a boy, it's a girl.
What's the difference?
Well, to me, male or female is language that we have attached to sex and the notion of the biological body. Whereas boy and girl are gender terms. Mm. And so it's fascinating that already when the baby comes out of the birth canal, again, we're using a gender word to speak about the baby's sex. And right there, there's your whole gender reveal party confusion that actually turns out to be telling us something.
The belief is then the gender is the person's sex. That's not gender, you say. Gender is determined not by biology. It's determined by culture. And more broadly, which we'll talk about some of this as we go, it's determined by mindset. It's determined by appearance. It's determined by behavior.
Right.
That's gender.
Yeah. And maybe just for the sake of the audience here, just to simplify, again, as I've said, simplifying is always sometimes a good place to start, and then we complicate from there. Just going to the dictionary will help. Because the dictionary defines sex in the biological domain and will say that it's actually linked to the reproduction, the two different types of reproductive functions and so forth. And my laptop dictionary just says genitals, right? So you can
really?
Think, yes, that's where my laptop goes. So you can think, you know, sex equals biology,
yeah.
simplistic way, gender equals culture.
Hmm.
But as I say very early on in the book, that's just not going to hold. Each of those terms, it's like we're, you know, kind of walking around on two banana peels. And each one is going to slide. And that's sort of the complication of the book that I want to present. It'd be easier if there really were just this fixed foot that is sex, it's uncomplicated, it's one thing, and then gender does a kind of creative dance, a kind of culturally changing thing, you know, on top of sex. That would be simpler, but that is really not the story we have to tell.
Catherine Bond Stockton. She's an English professor at the University of Utah. Her new book is called Genders. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's Politics Podcast is back with a new name. 45 Days is now State Street. I'm Sonia Hudson.
And I'm Emily Means. We're your hosts, taking a look at politics the Utah way. Now we're telling engaging stories that go beyond the legislative session.
Find State Street wherever you listen to podcasts, starting September 13th.
Until then, sign up for our newsletter at KUER.org/State Street.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and gender studies scholar Catherine Bond Stockton is with us today, talking about her new book, Genders. Basically, it's the story of gender. And in the book, she asks, where would you start? So we'll talk about the history of gender, but also what it means and how it's changing. Is gender a choice? And I use that word kind of advisedly here. And let me explain. So in the earliest days of the, you know, the culture war battle over gay rights and the question of sexual orientation, the question often was in the debate, in the argument, did someone choose that, you know, lifestyle was often the word you heard. Did they choose that? Like that there wasn't a genetic component to it. And now we think in more complicated ways about all of this. Now we think about epigenetics. We talk about how choosing sexuality isn't disqualifying to that question.
Right.
But where are we now in that matter of gender, the idea of it being something when you were young, whether it's baked into you,
well,
and does it matter?
Yeah. So let me start on the question of sexual orientation. And this is a complicated answer and a tricky one to give.
Okay.
So this is where we have to like listen carefully and tenderly, as I like to say.
I like how you use that word tender a lot. It's your way of trying to empathize with
To really understand
dated notions.
Yeah, and to understand where arguments come from. So the argument that, you know, nobody chooses their sexual orientation, for a long time that was the way people often talked in gay communities. And I give plural there, gay communities. Because I think people felt – and listen, this is how I felt. Like I don't know where this urge comes from, but I want to kiss girls. And that felt fixed and steady state and has been my whole life. So I'm one of those people that feels like it's one of the earliest things I have known. But to say born that way, again, I think is simplifying. I was born some way, as we've talked about, and I don't know the other factors that could have been in the mix that made me want to kiss girls. I like to think I'm a pretty discerning person, and kissing girls, you know, it just seems so amazing to me. Who doesn't want to kiss girls, you know, with their consent? So I get where that argument came from, and it was always a very powerful political argument, too, to be able to say, look, I cannot change the way that I am. And because so many of us feel that way, that has made sense. But there are so many other people, and I will just say there's a whole category of folks, many femme lesbians, might say, it's not that I feel that I was born this way. Somewhere along the line, I began to think, like, why am I only allowed to be attracted to half of the human beings on the planet? And I'm noticing that, you know, women are really pretty cool. And why would I not want to kiss a woman, right? So we've been denying that there are all kinds of people who are inside queer communities, broadly speaking, who may not have a born-that-way argument about themselves, and I want to deeply honor that. These are so many people that I know. Now, to go to the word choosing, and I actually have my partner's permission to use her, all right? So she is somebody who, for a good period of her life, into her 20s, was somebody who felt that she was attracted to men. That's who she is. She was actually engaged to be married to a very beautiful man that she adored. Very tragically, he was killed in a car crash, so that did not come to pass. She did not marry him. She ended up going on a peace march, long story there, and on the peace march met women called lesbians and thought, oh, lesbians are so cool. I wish I could be one, but I'm not one. Darn, you know. And later, after the peace march, came back to Utah, started a rock band with a group of women, and somebody shows up to the door, saxophone player. And she was like, what is this? I want to kiss this woman, right? So now it's a complicated story because to say that she's choosing at that point in time is complicated because her choosing is actually, you know, channeled by a number of different things that happened in her life. Clearly the death of her boyfriend. Long story here, she was then going to go on a Mormon mission.
Wow.
But she kept an LDS mission. She kept dreaming of swimming in the ocean, which you're not supposed to do on your mission, at least back then.
Right.
And so she went to see her bishop. Her bishop turned out to be somebody who had been a Buddhist and was now a Mormon.
What?
That's kind of rare. And that person said, since you're having this dream, I wonder if maybe you do need to stop, think about religion, think about your calling. And my partner was saying, you know, I just don't know if I can say this is the one true religion because I haven't studied any other religions. So before the peace march, she moves to San Diego to study religion. That's where she hears about the peace march. So look at all the things that had to happen. Mm-hmm. Many of those things she's not choosing. You would never say she was choosing many of the events that happened to her, tragic and joyful. But they are the things that lead her to then actually asking the question to herself, if I find this woman attractive, why wouldn't I kiss her?
Yeah.
So is that choosing or not? I don't know what word, but I think choosing is too strong, but born that way doesn't fit.
So, and why does it matter, right? Shouldn't we be at a point where, look, these are the circumstances that led them to be the person they are now.
Right.
And
yeah,
that's who they are.
Yes, it shouldn't matter. I completely understand why somebody who feels so strongly tied to the born that way narrative might. So I could imagine many places you might live in this state or elsewhere in these United States where what you are saying about your sexual orientation is not honored, is not embraced.
Yeah.
Maybe even in the depths of your own family, right? Still in danger of being kicked out of families.
For sure.
And so I think for some people to be able to say, and I think this is what people are saying, that this is the deepest thing I have known or felt about myself.
And they express it by saying they were born that way.
Yes, and some of us really did try to change. I mean, there were periods in my teens where if somebody could have waved a wand, maybe I would have said, you know, yes, take this thing out of me. But in all honesty, it's hard to say that you don't want to desire something that you do desire that gives you pleasure. And part of the reason I don't always love that born that way argument is it feels like it can, for some people, have a kind of self-loathing at its core, which is, trust me, I would never be this thing if I didn't have to be this thing. I've tried. Please don't, you know, let me not be this thing. I don't like that argument. This is a beautiful thing to be. I don't feel like we need to have that particular form of an argument, but I get why people do, why they're wedded to it, and also because it has often worked as an argument in some settings.
You write that gender is gestural.
Yes.
What do you mean by that? And maybe take us through a few of the gestures. I found this fascinating.
Yeah. You know, so I read this great book by Juana Maria Rodriguez, who's a wonderful theorist in my field, and I try to read everything I get my hands on by her. And she wrote this wonderful book. I think I have the title right, Sexual Futures, Queer Gestures, and Latina Longings. I think that's the right title. And in this fabulous book, she's trying to express how she sees a kind of interesting overlap between a type of exuberant motion that she calls a kind of over-the-topness that she sees with some Latinas, a certain type of gesturing, and that there's a kind of interesting intersect at times with the codes of, you know, queer gestures, and particularly by some queer men. So here I think in the book I say, you know, think Cardi B meets Jonathan Van Ness, you know. So that's sort of the story that she's trying to tell. But in the beauty of sort of really embracing this notion and the breadth and the complication of just what she's calling, you know, Latina gesture, she's really helping us all understand that gender is gestural, because the ways that we sort of express gender, right, comes out in the way that we hold our bodies, the way we move our hands, the sway, the movement, or the locked tightness of the walk, right? There's so many ways that we can think of as of gesture as being tied to gender. The classic one, right, is maybe the way that a gay man's hand would drop.
Let me give you another
one. Yes. Okay, yeah.
Because this was typical when I was in, I think, junior high school and high school. Mm-hmm. If a boy crossed his legs in a certain way, it was thought of as, you know, femmy.
Yes. Yes.
Is that an example?
That's a perfect example. And again, just to state the obvious, right, lots of boys do cross their legs. And you know, lots of gay men don't. And right, so these things are in no way, shape, or form absolute. Or are they biological, you know, to a person's body? They are deep-seated in culture, things we notice from childhood, the types of movements that we see, and the things that we start identifying with in our bodies. And yet some people might say, like, I don't care that you think the crossing of the legs is feminine. I do it joyfully, right? And so there's been a lot of recapture in an exuberant way of gestures that may have had shame sticking on them or projected onto them by other people, but there's an embrace of that particular gesture.
One of the things you write about, and an important part of the book, is you tell this larger history of gender. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that surprised me about that is that I just sort of assumed we had always had these notions, but we haven't, have we?
No. And as I always say to people, I feared writing this book partly for that exact reason, is how do I tell the history of this concept?
Yeah.
Because part of the MIT books is, you know, you've got this concept, it's on your cover, so give a little sense of the history of it. And that was the part that really stopped me. It's like, I don't know when I would say gender, you know, began. Where does that concept come from? And I thought, you know, have we had it for time immemorial? Would we say that? Or, you know, I often think of feminists as doing a very sort of important move, you know, beginning in the 1970s to say there's sex, but then there's gender, you know, sort of making that distinction that, you know, there's a lot of culture, right, in history and mandate, you know, packed into the thing called gender. So I thought maybe it's the feminists. But as I did the research for this book, I read a book by a friend of mine that is just so brilliant. Her name is Jules Gill Peterson, and she writes a book called Histories of the Transgender Child. And this is a book with just tremendous archival research behind it, really telling a sort of century-long history of how the concept of gender is ever born. So she's telling many different stories, but that's one of the things that she tells us. And it turns out that about five decades of research leads up to around 1950, when researcher John Money at Johns Hopkins University, running a clinic, actually develops this concept called gender. So we can actually put our finger on it. One can pinpoint it. Notice it's before sort of feminists do some of their cool things in separating sex and gender. But Money, and of course, I kind of love the strange pun that comes into this, right?
Pun.
Money's
in
our gender.
A few times. It's terrific.
Yes.
So 1950. Mm-hmm. And so explain what's going on at the time, because Money is responding to this, I don't know if it's a trend or this idea that humans are naturally and sexually indeterminate. I mean, he's trying to push against that, combat that.
Yes.
So
yes.
Explain this.
Absolutely. So one of the things that's happening is kids are being brought to the clinic, John Money's clinic at Johns Hopkins, and they are trans and intersex kids that are coming. Now, as Jules says in her book, and I really like this too, is that medicine didn't make trans kids, right? Kids who already sense strong things about themselves, you can tell, you know, from my story, right, are coming, and then medicine is sort of taking up what kids are saying about themselves. Huh. And medicine is taking it up in a particular way of, we can help change you, we can help correct you, we can finish your genitals. These are some of the sort of things that happen. But what's interesting, the story that Jules tells us in this book, is that the researchers at Johns Hopkins knew better than anybody else that sex is biologically indeterminate First of all, there are at least 5 fetal layers of sex. So there are 5 different things that form what you might call a baby sex, only one of which do we actually see if we're sighted people. And that's that genital configuration that we are reading when the baby comes out of the birth canal.
Which is layer 5.
Layer 5.
Yeah.
So many times bodies don't agree with each other. So funny to think, our bodies disagree with themselves. And so in this way, the kids that are being brought to the clinic are really sort of showing the researchers that this notion of a determinate, fixed, binary sex is not true. And that the predictors for male or female status are not reliably predictable. And therefore, to somehow address what they see as this crisis, that the binary sex is sort of crumbling before them, John Money comes up with a notion of gender. And he actually uses gender to say, okay, children are kind of changeable and plastic at birth and remain so, he says, up to 18 months.
Yeah.
And then after 18 months, children must grow in these developmental channels, male or female.
The either. Plastic hardens.
Exactly. So what had been plastic and indeterminate and changeable and could be reconfigured by surgery, you know, in John Money's view, then by 18 months starts to harden. And now there are only these 2 developmental channels, very important wording there, and that's what he calls gender, this male or female status. So it's really quite striking. As I say in the book, it's as if John Money and his colleagues roll 1950s norms on top of scientific data in order to defend against what the data showed. Mm-hmm. And if you ask, like, why did they do this? They actually use the argument that if a child doesn't grow in these developmental channels, if we don't channel the child in this way, they will be stigmatized. Hmm. They will suffer social stigma or psychological distress. So now if you think about that, society's enforced binary is the very thing that sort of forces this particular, you know, medical movement against medical research to get us to comply with a binary that actually doesn't exist.
You know what's intriguing about that for me in this section of the book is it made me wonder, let's say John Money's effort didn't pay off. It didn't stick.
Mm-hmm.
And I know counterfactuals are impossible, but just go with me for a second. What would have happened, do you think, if John Money and other cultural figures who were trying to push back against that, because there would have been others who would have not liked the idea of sex being indeterminate, sexually indeterminate. How would we have developed? Where would we be now, you know, 60 years hence?
Mm-hmm.
How would we have thought? How much grief would we have avoided and pain and and where would we have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I thought a lot about that. And some people say, you know, do you think there will be, you know, gender in the future? And of course, we don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But I think we're seeing something pretty interesting right now, in that we're seeing in some places, in some moments, greater latitude for children. Right?
Yeah.
Why would you need to dress a child in, you know, blue or pink? Why do you need to rehearse their, what you think of as their genitals, at the level of their hair? Really, like if you think about what we're doing, you could frame it in a particular way that we'd all find it pretty strange indeed, which is to say, I feel a need for the culture to know at every turn what my child's genital configuration is. I want those genitals rehearsed every minute of every day. And therefore, I will continue to use the word girl. I will use a name that has, you know, femininity sticking to it. I will do the hair in a particular way. I will dress them, the toys. This is gender fortification, that as soon as the baby comes out of the birth canal, we've lowered the cone on the baby now. It's either boy or girl. And now we're going to work with all this gender fortification. Why are we so insecure? Like if this thing was so natural, then it would have just unfolded naturally. But we act as if we must fortify constantly this thing that the baby doesn't even know about itself. Now, I do think there are some parents doing gender creative parenting, as it's called, and deciding not to sex gender a baby at birth, to just give the child a name that does not seem to signal a particular gender. and raise the child in that fashion until the child is a speaking person and starts to gravitate towards what it wants its surface presentation to be. Is there a name it prefers over the name that it was given? Mm-hmm. Is there a pronoun that they start wanting to use, or they would like to continue in this sort of non-binary way? Now, what's complicated about that is because gender is a system, right? As I describe it in the book, it's almost like a salmon swimming upstream. You know, the child may be having a delightful swim, but we also kind of know what is waiting for it, you know. So you can do the gender creative parenting, mm-hmm. but the problem is the system still awaits the child, and that's where we currently are. But there will be, it seems like there is more latitude now for kids even at early ages, maybe to use the word non-binary. I never thought that would catch on. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a pretty complicated word, but it has. Or for the child to say different things about who it feels itself to be. These are things we are now doing.
I want to talk about race. And mm-hmm. this is something that you and I have actually talked about before, that a lot of people think that your main interest is queer theory.
Mm-hmm.
But race has always been a big part of your mm-hmm. scholarship and your mm-hmm. thinking. You want to say something a little bit about that?
Yeah.
And then fold it into this larger idea, because in the book you say gender is always racialized.
So we use the word gender, but I would hope now if anybody reads my book, they would exit the book saying, right, gender is always racialized gender, and racialized gender is gender.
Yeah.
So yes.
Never forget that part.
Never forget that part, yeah. Because part of what I realized, even along the way in childhood, for the town that I grew up in, where I got to see people of lots of different backgrounds and renderings, was that I began to realize that the terms boy and girl had never confessed their racialized histories to me as a child. Hmm. And now I will say as a white child, right? So that this sort of notion of racialization can come much later for a white child, because I thought my problems are sex and gender. That's where I'm stuck, you know, the boy word and the kissing of girls, that's where I'm at. But so I was never dealing, you know, with my whiteness as a child. But if you think about the history of this country, going back to the 13 colonies, right, there are white men and white women and black men and black women and native men and native women in the 13 colonies.
So we've never had two sexes in this country.
I would say we haven't. And I say that carefully, because what I want to say is this is a fact of our history, legal distinctions that we made and often biological assumptions we rolled onto bodies given the legal distinctions and the crazy notions, you know, that were in our brains about different bodies. I strongly believe that these racialized histories at the founding of our country are still with us, and I think we need to reckon with them. But the long tentacles and the long roots of these racializations remain with us. And therefore, I think unless we're all going to pretend like our country is truly color neutral, then we are not out of this time period of there being at least six sexes in the history of this country. So right there, the notion of opposite sexes is blown out of the water by U.S. history and racial formation. I don't know how you could believe that there truly have been men and women when you take racial history into account, as I believe we must at every turn.
One of the focuses for how this history applies to others is you talk about the history of female slaves.
Yes.
Do you want to say something about that?
So, you know, I have a chapter called When Was Gender?
Yeah.
That's my second chapter. And I begin by telling the John Money story, right? So where does the concept of gender come from? 1950. Okay. And then, of course, I move through a lot of different feminists and a lot of different theorizations that have happened since that 1950 moment. And then I end that chapter by going back to the very concept of sex itself. Genitals, all right? And let's look at the field called gynecology, right? A field founded to medically study women's genitals. And as many people may know, that's quite a history behind that. So the man who is considered to be the founder of the field of gynecology, James Marion Sims.
The man.
a precise man that we can name.
Yes.
And sometimes a woman, a black female slave named Anarka, just with one name, is considered actually to be the mother of the founding of gynecology. And this is just a chilling story to the bone, which is to say James Marion Sims did his work to found the field of gynecology, study women's genitals, by doing operations on black female slaves. Black female slaves who were loaned to him by their slave masters, and particularly to study a particular circumstance called VVF, vesicovaginal fistula, which was a circumstance where if you had this fistula, which actually came from a crushing of the pelvic tissue, so often came from accidents, beatings, you can imagine why there were many female slaves who had this. Yeah. And the symptom that they had was uncontrollable involuntary urination. Now, many white women had this too, but many white women couldn't even face it, couldn't go to the doctor. Some women killed themselves. Black women, again, they had no control over being given over to James Marion Sims. He performed many of these operations without any anesthesia to cure this VVF. And when they were cured of this, he would then send them back to the slave master. Now, as if that isn't bad enough, here's the kicker in the whole story, which is to say the field of gynecology, women's medicine, is founded on black enslaved female flesh, people who could not be considered women because of the definition of woman in that time.
The question of who is my opposite is an important part of the book as well. Mm-hmm. You say the phrase opposites attract. Makes no sense. And in fact, it has caused havoc, is how you put it.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about it and maybe start – because I found this fascinating, and people who know the play Hedwig and the Angry Inch may know this story because it's beautifully rendered there.
It is.
It goes back to Plato. You want to say a little bit about this?
Yeah. So it's an idea that comes from the Symposium.
Yeah.
That at the dawn of time there were these three sort of roly-poly forms that existed on the earth. So one was essentially if you thought about like two male bodies sewn back to back. All right, so four legs, four arms, two faces, one head, all right? And then a body where it looked like a female body and a male body are sewn back to back, all right? So they're rolling around. And for some reason that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, Zeus feels threatened by these roly-poly forms. And so he thinks about just destroying them. But instead of destroying them, as the story goes, he cuts them each in half. And this then becomes the story of the origins of love. I can't even say the phrase without thinking of the Hedwig, song.
Yeah. It's great, by the way.
Yeah. So the origin of love is that once cut in half, these two halves are ever looking for each other. Hmm. So the two male halves would be looking for each other, the two female halves would be looking for each other, and the male and the female half. So this would sort of give rise to the words that we have had medically and problematically in our culture, heterosexual and homosexual, right? And what's interesting about Plato is, as I sort of say in the book, it's taken us a long time to just catch up with Plato, yeah. Right? Because really, in the way that we have sex children at birth, it is as if we've taken a sword and cut them in half and determined then that they must spend their lives looking for that lost opposite half. And that would – once you find – if you're a woman, you find your perfect man, you come together, you become one flesh, you're back together, you are whole once more. But think of all the implications of that notion. We're basically confessing that we're making children that we conceive of almost as half a human being at the beginning. And they can only have these traits. And because they're opposite, right, if a boy is brave, then a woman is not. If a man is rational, a woman's irrational. If a man is logical, a woman is feeling. We literally have signed on to these nutty notions, I would call them. And it's created tremendous havoc because it makes people feel to begin with they will not be whole unless they are in a relationship, married, coming back and finding their opposite in life. And it's given rise to what I think are deeply incoherent notions of heterosexual and homosexual. Then once again, you can't really have opposites in this clear, lucid, unproblematic way that we pretend.
One of the questions you also ask is, what are the urgencies that remain here? And you say that you want readers of the book to, you say, enter this text and let's build a better argument. So let's end there. How is the argument playing out, the conversation? What are the urgencies that remain? How are you seeing this? You've talked about where you'd like it to go. Do you think that matches with where we're headed?
So let me say two things about that, and these both are unhappy things. So let me just sort of say them both. So going back to the question of surface, one of the reasons why I think it is very important for us to think about surface is because surface is deep. So this is something that I want us to understand, because I think, as both of us would confess, what we have worn on our surface, if we've worn something on our surface for a very long time, whiteness, white skin, right, the term man or woman, that does bake into our thinking. That does form our thought about what we can do, who we can be, what our possibilities are, what we might get paid, how I sit in my chair, right? I mean, these surfaces are so powerful, and the words that have been put upon us, so not just the way that we look, but also the word that seems that we seem to be wearing at our surface as we're read by other people. And one of the things about the so-called racial reckoning that we thought our country, you know, might be having, that we might still have, was, I hope, you know, a very strong sense of urgency to reckon with white skin privilege, right? For people who have not really engaged their whiteness, which is true for so many of us, and however much you think you've engaged it, I say this about myself, there's so much more still to engage. And the sort of privilege that comes with what is worn at the surface. So this is why I say surface is very deep, because it forms us in many ways. And indeed, the thing that we might think of as the depth behind our eyes can get a lot of play from surface. But it can be, too, that somebody behind their eyes is having a tremendous, rigorous, educated struggle with what has gone on at the level of their surface. This is what I hope people would do who have white skin privilege, is to be really undertaking that struggle of, what does it mean that this is what is at my surface? I must reckon with this every single day. So there's a way, again, about thinking about gender as always racialized gender will help us with that. Another reason why I say surface is deep is, sometimes a very loving parent comes to me, but a parent who's very sort of broken up over the fact that their child is saying that, you know, what they were assigned at birth is not who they feel themselves to be, not who they feel they are. And the parent is just like, well, why can't they, you know, in a sense, just like, okay, so they were assigned a girl, but why can't they just stay a girl and then do the boy things they want to do? And I just, you know, like, this just, you know, hurts my soul to see this change at the level of the surface. And I say to them, you have just answered the question yourself. How strongly you feel attached to their surface, their beautiful surface, is how strongly they feel attached to their own. So if it's so hard for you to see this surface change, you must understand why surface is so intimate and so deep to who we are. So use that knowledge. Use that knowledge that you realize about yourself. Use the knowledge of your heartbreak to understand the urgency for your child who is saying, I must make this surface change.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Catherine Bond Stockton. She's an English professor at the University of Utah. Her new book is called Genders. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Stu Nolan is our intern. The program is produced by Tim Slover, Benjamin Bombard, and Kerry Watson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.